to FinTech's DEI Discussions podcast series. We are here today to celebrate the wins, raise awareness of the challenges, and walk the talk for change across the entire financial technology industry. And today we are joined by Amber Skinner-Josephson, CEO and co-founder at EPOP. She is here to share how she walks the talk for inclusion in our sector and, more importantly, what more she wants done. Amber, it is so cool to have you here on the show today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Nadia, for the invite. I'm really excited about this conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'd love it if you could start off by telling us a bit more about your role and just some snapshots of your career journey.
Sure, I would love to. As you said, I'm currently the CEO and co-founder of EPOP. EPOP, which stands for Electronic Proof of Purchase, provides data and insights into retail consumer behavior. So we're really a fintech that works in the retail space, retail technology space. And we do that through digitalizing receipts and then turning them into smart receipts, where we can see a load of details about shopper preferences and behaviors based on real purchases and not kind of guesses through demographics or inferences, all the way down to the SKU or the item level. So we work with retailers primarily. So retailers do a really good job. When I say retailers, I mean big box retailers and small retailers, like everybody from CVS to Boots to Walmart, you know, Tesco. These are all retailers. Retailers do a really good job of seeing what happens within their four walls, so they know how inventory moves within their systems. But what they don't see is what happens and what buyers and shoppers do as soon as they step foot outside of their stores. But I can see that users send their receipts, and we have access to their receipts online, offline, online again. So I see the 360-degree shopper journey, whereas retailers really see what happens within their four walls. So that's what I do right now. I started my career as a newspaper journalist in the United States. I migrated pretty quickly from journalism to corporate communications in a variety of industries, but primarily telecommunications and technology at that stage. From there, I transitioned to marketing, which was very straightforward and very organic. Since then, I've worked primarily in financial services, particularly fintech. The last big corporate that I've worked for, was Swift. So that's in cross-border payments. I had the opportunity to join an FCA regulated consumer lending and alternative credit scoring fin right as the pandemic hit. I joined, my first full day was March 18th, and I think March 19th, the whole of the UK went into lockdown. So I will remember that date forever. I joined that company as CMO and then left as CEO at my time there. And from there, I joined a couple of former colleagues who had started building out EPOP. That was a couple of years ago. And since then, I've been building and working with an incredible team to bring our product and vision to life. Like I said, I'm from the U.S. I grew up in the U.S. I lived a few years in Asia. I lived 5 years in France, in Paris. And then for the past 10 years, I've been here in the U.K.
What a journey. That is super exciting. And it all sort of stacks up and sort of makes sense that, you know, this background that you have in journalism and then marketing and how you've been able to take all these different lessons and experiences to make you who you are today and to drive this business forward. Like, I absolutely love it. It's so exciting to hear it. But there's also an experience before that that I'd like for you to share with us. And that's when you were at Howard University and your experience there. And you've told me that's really set you up for your career. I'd love for you to share that with us.
Sure. That is, I'm going to try to be a little bit concise, but I'm not necessarily concise when I talk about Howard. I love Howard so much. So attending Howard University was one of the most important and arguably best decisions of my life. I went there for my undergraduate degree, and it completely changed the trajectory of my life. And for anyone who doesn't know Howard University, it's an HBCU, which means a historically Black college or university. Howard is an extremely prestigious and important institution for Black Americans and throughout the entire Black diaspora. It's based in Washington, D.C. So there I studied print journalism at Howard for my undergraduate degree. And like most people between roughly 18 and 22 years old, that is a very formative period of their life. It's when most of us are really cementing and solidifying who we are and who we want to be as adults, as young adults. I think the general understanding of human development is that the prefrontal cortex isn't fully formed until something like our mid-20s. So the typical undergrad experience is where we are figuring out how to plan, how to prioritize, and how to just make good decisions by ourselves as young adults. And for me, being at a Black school during this period of time really shaped my opinion about subjects, topics, ways of working, ways of being, values, and all of these things that continue to be pillars in my life. The way I moved through this world was very largely shaped by my time at Howard. And I took that form of participation in a bunch of different clubs, you know, activism, marches to the Supreme Court. As you can imagine, Howard was very important for the U.S. civil rights movement. Important civil rights figures either attended or were affiliated with Howard. So seeing and learning this up close and personal was really life altering. One example in particular, one class in particular, actually, was African American history. That was so impactful to me in terms of how I viewed myself, my country, contributions of Black Americans to the world, and then my future as well. So every American student, you know, studies American history in social studies class for 10 years or something outside of February, which in the US, February is Black History Month. I know it's October in the UK, but outside of February, I had never studied African American history before. It's hard to articulate or even to identify all of the ways in which attending an HBCU like Howard shaped my thinking. But you asked me that question, and there are three things that I think are really specific. One is academic excellence. So the only way that I got to go to Howard was on full academic scholarship. I did not have a choice but to maintain a very high grade point average. And at the time, it very much felt like life or death as a situation for me, myself. Death being the prospect of losing my scholarship and having to leave Howard. But I was not alone in that. You know, I wasn't a super, super stellar high school student. But being at Howard and seeing all of this Black academic excellence around me just automatically, you know, elevated my goals, my aims, what I thought was possible of me. And I had never been in a scenario like that. So a lot of my classmates and friends were also on scholarships, and academic achievement, academic excellence, academic pursuits were just normal, given the standing and the rigor of the institution. The other thing that was very incredibly important to me was the diversity. And that sounds weird, but let me explain what I mean. Interestingly, Howard was the most diverse environment I have probably ever been in, even though you're like, wait, everyone is Black, it's a Black school. And I mean, in terms of socioeconomic diversity, cultural diversity, country of origin, et cetera. So different kinds of diversity than I had seen before. And very quickly, that became the normal. And that was expected. So when you're in it, especially when you're young, you can get used to anything, right? Humans can get used to anything, which is why things like representation are so important. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But I got so used to being surrounded by different kinds of diversity that I hadn't been exposed to before. But all the time, seeing all Black students pursuing degrees, advanced degrees, becoming doctors, becoming educators, becoming professionals, before I graduated and went on the world of kind of white collar work, that was cemented as normal for me. And the third thing I wanted to talk about, which really changed and set me up, was network. So I didn't come from a family that was highly networked, you know, kind of outside of my little town in Western Colorado. And we're all parts of networks, social networks, religious, academic, professional, et cetera. But when you go to a private liberal arts university in the US, part of what you're paying for is entry into that network. And it's at Howard that I really realized that. It's the same here in the UK. It's the same everywhere that you go. There are networks and there's entry, you know, entry barriers into particular networks. What I hadn't seen before was a network in action that I could really identify. And Howard has a very active, very robust, and really meaningful network of alums. Kamala Harris, the VP of the United States, went to Howard, for example. And I mean, I could list, like, rattle off tons of people that are very influential and important that went to Howard. So when I say network, I also mean the work that is involved in becoming part of the network and the benefit on the other side. So as a student, for me, that meant finding mentors, finding advisors, connecting with other people and an ecosystem that prepared me for professional life in a very significant way.
What a powerful story. I absolutely loved listening to that. And what really stood out for me is diversity, right? Like, it's so interesting because I think, you know, when we talk about inclusion in the workplace, diversity in the workplace, what do we actually mean? And I think that you're there talking about a level that so many people wouldn't even have considered. But this is actually the power of diversity and then the network around that. And I absolutely love everything that you say about just the high performance element of it and like how that's just set you up for just everything in life. Like, it's just so important. And I think, you know, when we're talking about how do we have a more diverse workforce, what can we do about the pipeline? you know, people often think, oh, we'll just deal with, you know, college years. But actually, it's even further back, you know. It's so important to hear that story. And takes me on to my next question, where we were talking about being in the workplace and the workplace experience, and actually being a minority in the workplace. An individual as a minority often has to navigate that room in a very different way than their privileged and often majority privileged counterparts. I want you just to share some of your thoughts on that, because I think this will be quite eye-opening for some people.
Sure. That is very much true. And that happens whenever you're the only, and I say only in quotes, or one of the few. So the only woman, the only person from X country or X culture or X religion, the only minority, et cetera. It happens when you're the only or one of the very few. Life and our society is such that the minority is the one who needs to navigate everybody else. And what did that mean on a day-to-day or a year-to-year basis? Well, traditionally, that's meant that you have to very quickly find and work very hard to maintain points of commonality with everybody else. That's part of survival. That's something that you've got to do quickly and then maintain that. Say, hey, we're the same. So the minority needs to do that, or traditionally has had to need to do that. There are some people who just have big personalities that they come in and they're, you know, unique and they're bold about it. And they're it seems like they're celebrated for that, et cetera. That's very few people. For the rest of us, we have to find ways to appear like the majority in order to either one, not stand out as the odd one, or ironically, the opposite, to not be forgotten about and overlooked and therefore excluded. So it's two very tiresome extremes, but that's kind of the danger of not doing that. Humans are tribal, and being part of a minority tribe means that you had better adapt to survive. And I can say this from my own experience, that navigating the workplace as an only often felt like a survival quest. And it may not seem like a big deal. If you've never experienced that, it may be like, okay, well, you know, just get on with, you know, it may not feel like a big deal, but when you're in that position, it's not something that you can afford to not think about and not to consider. So a few years ago, maybe it's 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe I'm losing track of time and it's longer than that, a study or a report or something came out about how much more time female professionals spend getting ready in the morning than their male counterparts. And then maybe some of your listeners are like, what the hell difference does this make? But this equates to, you know, compounded X many fewer hours of sleep and X many more micro decisions that have to be made even before starting to work. So starting to make big decisions. So compounded over time, this hinders and penalizes female professionals across the board. They have to navigate more. They just do. They have to make more decisions on a daily basis. They have to get up earlier. They're scrutinized more on how they look, physical appearance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a gender-specific example. Layer on top of that ethnicity and culture or language or physical ability or anything else. And then again, compounded over time, this navigation is heavy and burdensome. And it leads to, you know, lots of things that we already know about. High rates of burnout, quitting the workforce, changing industries, just saying, you know, enough is enough. What the hell? This is a lot to carry. So it's a thing that you can never afford to not think about. And compounded over time, it's a very heavy thing to carry.
Yeah, it really is. And again, I really like how you describe that as being the only. It's often something we talk about in recruitment when someone's the first, and just the burden of that, it's really powerful. But also another part of this is that you felt liberated from it by starting up your own company. So I'd love to hear that.
Sure. Yes. And to a very large extent, I do. On an everyday basis, I do. While I'm the only woman on our founder team, my other two co-founders are both of Indian origin. And for me, that's extraordinary. Like, it's extraordinary. I've never worked on an all-ethnic minority leadership team before. That, for me, is extraordinary. There are a lot of reasons I really enjoy running startups, lots of reasons, not least of all, is because I can do a lot more my way with less what I would call distracting pressure. So there are a lot of pressures that are necessary and motivating, right? They get our adrenaline up, and it's either for survival or motivating us or doing something big or getting the energy to face a challenge, pitching, you know, getting partners, selling, releasing new product features, being generally super competitive in our space. There are a lot of good pressures, but then there are other pressures that I just got very tired of managing and carrying. And some of them I talked about before, but that's more on pressure to conform, to present in a specific way, to be mindful of labels, being perceived as being relatable yet non-threatening, me having to do the work to find commonalities with folks who don't look like me, et cetera. So that just kind of became, you know, it took up a disproportionate amount of my time the further up the ladder I climbed in the corporate world. And I didn't want to spend my time doing that or my energy doing that. So there's just a shocking lack of diversity when it comes to startup entrepreneurs as well. So while I am loving running startups in my own company myself with my co-founders, there's just a lack of diversity among entrepreneurs and investors. We hear a lot about that in the news. There are a lot of stats. I think that it's like 1.5% of VC-backed founders are women, and then less than 1% are Black. I mean, these things are shocking to me, right? So in another way, I've jumped from, what's the expression,
pan into the fire, yeah.
I would say I feel like I have a lot less pressure to conform on a daily basis, which frees up my mind and my emotions to focus on what I feel like is more important and is moving the needle.
And it does make such a difference. You know, you look at people in sports and, you know, there's like millimeter differences in someone's helmet or their knee pads or, you know, whatever it is. And then, you know, we're thinking about all of the impacts that make a difference to somebody's day, from microaggressions to how you navigate that, to how you actually keep someone focusing on you when you're making the point in the room, when they want to hear it from somebody that they associate themselves with more, or they want to finish up with that joke or whatever it may be. There's so much to navigate. So it's such an important point. And you know, it really makes me so pleased that you've joined us on this podcast, because I know that, you know, when we first spoke, you said, hey, I've got this love-hate relationship with DEI. So I just wanted you to share with everybody, you know, where that comes from and your thoughts around it.
Yeah, absolutely. We did talk about this. We talked about this for a long time, and I have this conversation a lot with other female founders, with just other women and minorities, executives that I know. And I'll start off by saying DEI is essential. It is crucially important as a way to view hiring, business, professional life, and the world. So if we put just kind of the moral aspect of it aside, for just a moment, at this stage in 2024, only a fool does not believe in the benefit of diversity within business for performance. We already know that diverse teams perform better. They generate greater revenue. They're stronger financially. We know this already. The question is, how do we get to more diversity everywhere it's needed? Of course, equality in hiring, equality in promoting and firing, and very importantly, allocation of resources. And greater inclusion in the process from top to bottom is really needed. What I see as dangerous is anything that is this important that is secluded in its own department or team. This becomes a symbol and a target. So I've seen enough corporate prunings, let's call them prunings, although it's kind of like swaths of folks being let go. And I've had to preside over layoffs myself enough to know that an isolated limb becomes too easy to axe. And we're seeing that right now, especially in the US. So we're seeing everyone abandoning their DEI initiatives, kind of left, right, and center. It's retreat on all fronts. Following summer 2020, after the George Floyd murder, DEI departments and heads of DEI popped up everywhere, it seemed. The question I asked myself right away was, okay, all right, how effective, this is nice to see, but how effective are these teams, are these departments, are these appointments? What kind of mandate were they really given, and over what kind of timeline? And now we're seeing political pushback and backtracking in the form of some very outspoken advocates for doing away with DEI as an entire concept. And these departments, teams, and heads of are being cut all over the place. Not only that, backing and funding. So I talked about allocation of resources in general are being withheld. So I think of what Fearless Fund is living through in the US, which is absolutely egregious. So these symbols have been very easily abandoned. I'm also old enough and am enough of a student of history to understand that progress is not linear. So when it comes to moving forward, sometimes we overshoot, but more often and more to the point, often we undershoot as a society, right? But it's all moving us forward incrementally. That's how I feel about DEI in general. Is the workplace more diverse today than it was when I was a Howard student? Yes, it is. And we're talking about it, and we're making progress towards evolving institutions and practices and mindsets. We're taking steps forward and we're taking steps backward, and we're pushing incrementally towards the future. And for me, this is the most important effect of DEI as a corporate symbol, I feel.
I think it's really important for me to remember that as well. I'm really glad that, you know, you've said that's made a massive impact on me, because often, you know, when those steps back are happening, I can really feel it and I can forget that we have moved forward. And you're absolutely right. There's steps forward, there's a few back, there's forward, there's back. Yes, if we look back over the last 20 years, are we further forward? Well, we are. So that's really powerful what you said there. And then thinking about next gen, you said that representation matters. You mentioned it earlier. I'd love for you to tell us more.
Representation matters so much. And this seems, I mean, this is kind of a no-brainer. And there's been so much research done on this, but we tend to forget it. And we tend to forget exactly how it is impactful. And I believe very strongly, just for myself, that my purpose in this world is to create more opportunities, especially for young women of color. And I'll summarize why I think representation matters so much. And I'll summarize it in two points. One is recognition, empowerment, and inspiration. So it takes a very special, and it's a very rare mind, to project yourself into a role where nobody looks like you and nobody ever has before. There are some minds like that, but it takes a very special mind. For the rest of us, representation expands what we know to be possible. It's as simple as that. But what does that lead to? What does that even mean? Who cares about that? What is the end result? The next part of that is economic and social empowerment. We know that representation translates into tangible benefits like increased access to economic opportunities, better representation in legislative bodies, and improved things like policies that address the needs of diverse communities. We know this. And that's what I'm very interested in. Once again, leaving aside we see always on social media things like, my God, representation matters, and it does. And we see, you know, young girls looking at, I don't know, a Little Mermaid and what it means to them, or seeing somebody with the same disability as them on screen. And we can see that's a very tangible example that those are caught on film. And we can see for that moment what representation matters. But in the larger picture, the two areas that I really focus on is recognition, empowerment, and inspiration as one that leads to more economic and social empowerment and equality.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And with two little ones as well, like the example of the Little Mermaid is just everything to me. And changes in the right direction. Also, in a previous conversation, you mentioned to me that there's something about the next generation of workers that you really admire. You hit the nail on the head. So I definitely want you to let the audience hear this.
Sure. I love young people. I don't get to, I would say, hang out with, or I don't come into contact as often as I would like to with young folks, teenagers, young professionals. But in my job, I do get to talk to a lot of young entrepreneurs, especially female entrepreneurs, and I am completely blown away by them on a regular basis. They are incredible. I think they are savvier than we were. And when, you know, I'm 40. So when I say we, I mean kind of my generation of women. I think they're savvier. They have more technology and more channels by which to build and create. And they do that. And more importantly for me is that they are more fearless. I hear them talk about subjects and concepts that were taboo and just straight up terrifying when I was their age to raise. There was no way that I would raise some of these things in the workplace, like climate change, workplace equality, fair wages, you know, fair treatment in the workplace, gun control, LGBTQ issues. I mean, the list goes on. And they are entrepreneurial. They can build something from nothing so quickly. And besides their just inherent entrepreneurial spirit, I think what I'm really impressed about is the way that they lead with their values in a way that I could never have imagined in my early 20s. That really, I'm really impressed by that. And I think the future is very bright.
Makes you feel so positive when, you know, when we highlight this. And I know that there'll be people listening going, yes, that is so true. I haven't realized that, or I've overlooked that, or I haven't been used to that. Well, it's powerful. And yes, the future's bright with it. And I think everything that you've said today has been just so either eye-opening or a great reminder of where we are and what more we need to do. So it takes me to my last question. So I always introduce these podcasts saying we're here today to walk the talk, because, you know, I want us to be more action orientated when it comes to conversations like this. And I do believe that we all have a role to play. And I love saying that inclusion includes everybody. So what would you like to see more of from the audience for genuine, authentic workplace inclusion?
Yeah. So I wrote an article about this a few years ago, and this was really off the back of summer of 2020. And I was here in the UK, and the crux of it kind of went like this, that we all have a role to play in moving us forward. And of course, that goes for progress in general. Progress is made in a number of different places and on a number of different fronts, from marching in the street, you know, activism that's very vocal, volunteering, speaking up. Progress is also made quietly by being in the room where decisions are made. And that takes a lot as well. I don't want to diminish or discount that, because I feel like that's part of my role as well. So being in the room, in a position to be able to direct and allocate resources and funds to more diverse groups, like that's a big one. Providing medical care for underrepresented communities, that's a huge one. Being part of the 1% of founders, building a business that's not a traditional founder profile, influencing hiring within a company, being in local politics. There are a number of ways that are quieter, but being in that position in the first place means that you can more fairly dictate and wield your power. So it's not one archetype. There are so many ways to push progress forward. I think in terms of, I think of immediate or medium term. That's about it. That's the way that my mind works. So immediately, what I would like to see is more mentoring of underrepresented groups. I would like to see that immediately. So we talked about the importance of networks, and I talked about how this next generation is amazing and innovative and brilliant. They have new skills that are not always recognized, but more importantly, are not always valued. So whoever you are, if you're listening this to whoever you are, if you're 60 years old and white and male, if you're 25 years old and brown or black and female or anything in between, go find some young people from underrepresented backgrounds, students, young professionals, it doesn't matter, and mentor them, right? Introduce them to opportunities, share your knowledge, even if you have 1 year or 2 years of professional experience, share what you've learned, help them do it better. So that's one thing I think we can all do now. That's what I would like to see now. In the medium term, I'd like to see much greater diversity in terms of allocation of resources and capital. So the world needs diverse entrepreneurs and businesses. The majority can't get off the ground or they're completely crushed before they even get started. And it's because traditional investors don't invest in non-traditional founders. They just don't. So changing this, supporting these businesses and these entrepreneurs can change so much. It changes who gets hired, professional opportunities, community served, accumulation of wealth, and so on. So much progress can come off the back of funding and supporting diverse founders and entrepreneurs. Full stop.
Amber, it's been an absolute pleasure. Like, I'm so excited that you shared so many of this. I love that discussion around loudly making change happen, but also quietly doing it. And all of us being able to bring the way that we can affect change to the party is the way forward. And I really appreciate you sharing all of that with us. So thank you for joining us on FinTech's DEI Discussions. Let's listen, let's learn, let's walk the talk. Thank you.